We've been discussing the concept of emunah for the past several weeks. Probably just last week I was under the weather, so I couldn't make it. Thank God I'm feeling much better now. But the last time we spoke, we discussed how you can discover emunah, faith, and constant connection to God through three different venues. We said one was through nature and creation, science, the physical world. The second revelation of God came after creation. It came at Mount Sinai, came through the events of the Exodus, and that we'll discuss as discovering God through the Torah, and using the Torah as a way to strengthen your faith and connection to God. And the third one, which we'll discuss, God willing, next week, is recognizing God through the final redemption in the future, which we'll discuss what that means next week, God willing. But today I want to focus on emunah coming through the Torah. Now, just to clarify what I mean by that, we mentioned there's three revelations in history. God revealed himself to the world, or will reveal himself to the world three times. The first time was in creation. The second time were all the events, starting from when Moses went to the burning bush, all the way through the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. That was all one long event in history. That was all God communicating with the human being and passing on his will into our world through the Torah, through the miracles of the Exodus. And the third revelation will be, God willing, soon, the final redemption, coming of the Mashiach, when God will reveal himself once again to the world. But the second revelation, the revelation through the events of the Exodus and Torah, that, and for all intents and purposes, in our daily life, is the most relevant and powerful revelation of God. Finding God through nature, as we discussed, you do see the power of God in nature, but it's not always so clear. You're not left with understanding what God's will is in your life based on seeing how powerful the human eye is, as we discussed last time. So you understand that there's a power, there's a design to this world. You see the beauty and the kindness and the complexity of God's creations, but you don't know, what does that mean to me? How do I connect with God? What does he want out of me? What's my purpose? What should I do with my life? That you don't get through nature, at least not very easily at all. The revelation of God through the Torah and the events of the Exodus is meant to be for us the way which God is making an exhibit, a spectacle for all of history. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is how you can relate to me. I'm going to show you my power. Those are all the miracles of the Exodus. And then I'm going to give you my book, my will, the Torah, and then you're going to know what I'm all about, as much as a human being can understand. You'll know what I want out of you, what you're supposed to do in this world. So the events of the Exodus and the giving of the Torah, I think from several different angles, can help strengthen our emunah, our constant faith in God. And we'll try to discuss some of these angles. This is really a topic that could go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. I'm going to try to condense it into one session. But there's a lot of angles we could take on this. So number one would be, very simply, the actual events which occurred at the Exodus and at Mount Sinai. Forgetting the actual giving of the Torah, but the events which occurred. Meaning the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, the Jews walking through the desert, the revelation of Mount Sinai, everyone hearing God speak at Mount Sinai, the thunder and lightning around the mountain, Moshe ascending up into the clouds to speak with God, bringing down the tablets. Those events are really our definitions of who God is in terms of how we can understand God, what God does in this world. And those are events which we focus on, you know, constantly as Jews, especially Pesach is the time which is set aside for it, mostly. But it's a constant focus of Jews. The actual events of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, that the entire nation heard prophecy, that's something which, if we contemplate what that means in our lives, what that means in history, should definitely strengthen our emunah. And I'm going to elaborate more on each of these points. I'm just trying to give you the outline first. The next point is the impact the Torah has had on the world. Ever since the Jews were at Mount Sinai received the Torah, the world has become a different place. At this point, you know, majority of people in the world's, you know, the Western world's three major religions all recognize the Jews received the Torah at Mount Sinai, and it's changed our perspective towards morality, towards ethics, towards divine will. There is the impact of us understanding the wisdom and depth of the Torah. Anybody who's taken time to study Torah has seen that the depth of Torah is infinite, and what the Torah addresses in life. There's no area in life Torah is not addressed. The Torah addresses everything. There's something which I would recall Rabbi Noach Weinberg Zatzal, who was the founder and the Rosh Yeshiva of Eshet Torah in Jerusalem. So he has a whole series of classes where he tries to prove the Torah. And one of his proofs he calls the experiential proof, which means that if one actually, you can't necessarily explain it to others, but if one actually starts observing the Torah, you feel something. studying Torah yourself, observing Torah yourself, you feel a connection. And we'll discuss that more. That's called the experiential proof. And then you have another interesting area, which is the actual information in the Torah, beyond all the life lessons and the mitzvot, but you do find information in the Torah, which the rabbis seem to have information which preceded science. I want to discuss that as well. Because the divine revelation of the Torah means that God knows science. God knows how the world works. And science, as we know, has advanced and developed over the centuries. We always have new developments in science. But you find astounding things throughout the works of the rabbis from 2,000 years ago, which predate the scientific discovery. And then science discovers it in the past 100 years. You say, well, that's exactly what the rabbis were saying, in this Midrash, or in this part of the Talmud, or in this, this commentary on this verse. So I'm going to discuss that as well. But that's kind of our outline of different ways in which the Torah can strengthen our Emunah. So let's take them one by one. The first one we mentioned was the Exodus. The Exodus itself, if we want to know, when I say, do you believe in God? And you answer to me, let's say we answer yes. Hopefully we answer yes. So we say, what is God? All right? And the person will say, I don't know. You have to be able to, if you say you believe in it, you have to know what it means. What is God? To say God is all-powerful, God's a creator, God runs the world. We have to have a definition. We have to know, when I say I believe in God, what do I mean by that?
Personification is something that always troubles me. When we talk about God, we always say he. We always refer to him. And so the question is, who is God versus what is God? You're looking at it from what is God because of it's all-encompassing?
Yeah, I'm saying, when I say I believe in God, I have to know, what does that word mean to me? When I say there's a Jewish core belief called we believe in God, well, what does that mean? So I think the personification of God, when we refer to God, I think there's a mistake out there, because people say we refer to God in the male form, not in the female form. The truth is, if you look through different works of different parts of the Torah, you do refer to God with feminine words as well sometimes. I'm trying to think of an example offhand. In the Kedusha prayer, said, and if someone who uses the Svar text of the Siddur, in the Kedusha prayer, they say, Naritzach v'nakdishach. So male would be Naritzcha v'nakdishcha. But they say Naritzach v'nakdishach, which is to a female. In Hebrew, Lach is a female. I mean, we refer to God with both traits, because God's all-encompassing. God has female traits, we'll call it male traits. Which, again, we have to define what that means as well. But I think it's a mistake when people say or refer to God as a man. God's not a man or woman. God is God. God's infinite. There's no man or woman or anything, right?
That's the closest dogma or example that we can use in our minds, but we know that that's just a filler, that's not really the all-encompassing meaning. But it's what we can relate to.
Right, yeah, so
we always say him, though.
Yeah, in speech we talk about him, but if you look through sources, midrashic sources, you look at different verses in the Tanakh, sometimes you do use female expressions for God as well. The Shekhinah, God's presence, is a female term. Shekhinah is a female term. So we have to understand that there's different aspects, and God's all-encompassing, God's neither male nor female. God is God. So if we want to know what is it that we believe, we say we believe in God, what does that mean? So we look at the Exodus, because the Exodus, this is a famous comment from Nachmanides. In the Exodus, God tells us, this is who I am. Look what I can do. I care about what people do in this world. I punish the wicked. I reward the righteous. I overturn nature. I can perform miracles. I have a will. I have a desire. I control the world. I'm infinite. Those are all the things you see throughout the Exodus. If you read the Torah describing the Exodus, there's a constant refrain, so you should know that I am God in the land. I am God in the heavens. I am God who controls everything. There's a refrain there, because God is saying, and the reason, why did God make such a spectacle of the Exodus? Why did he make such fireworks? Could have plucked the Jews out of Egypt and stuck them into the desert very easily without any fireworks. The answer is, God wanted to make a display at that point, because how are we going to understand God? So he said he's displaying himself to us in the way he wants to be understood. Therefore, he performs all these miracles in Egypt, so we understand him. Now, those miracles in Egypt, they can't just happen and be forgotten. So God says, because I made this spectacle, and I taught you about myself during these events, during this course of, you have your 40 years in the desert, you have, the rabbis say, there was 12 months of plagues in Egypt. So during that course of time, that's when I reveal myself. But I don't want you to forget about that, because this is my revelation for history. So therefore, I want you to sit down every single year with your family at a Seder and relate the story. And I want you to write it in your tefillin and put it on daily. And I want you to mention a verse about the Exodus daily, which is a mitzvah, to mention a verse about the Exodus night and day. And I want you to redeem your firstborn sons from a Kohen. And I want you to redeem to sanctify your firstborn animals. And I want you to do all these things so you remember the Exodus, because that is the revelation for history. You cannot forget that. And you sit back and think about, so when we talk about trying to strengthen our own personal mood on these events, God defined himself and he showed us how significant they were. And we're supposed to make sure we never forget. So we have a chain, an unbroken chain, linking ourselves back to Egypt. Because our great-great-great-grandparents in Egypt sat down with their children and told them the story. And their children told their children the story. And they passed on their story to their children, to their children, to their children, to their children, all the way down to this very day. And we, and they make like an estimate, we're about the 133rd generation or so since the Exodus. So 133 people in each family, parent to child, every single year, have told this story. And that links us all the way back to Egypt. I personally remember being at a Seder with my grandparents, Aliyah Mashalom, and probably many of you also remember that. And my grandparents remember being a Seder with their grandparents. And it keeps on going back. And that's an unbroken chain linking us back to the Exodus itself. And as I think Nachmanides also says, you know, parents don't pass on lies to their children. Obviously, when the story was told, it was because it was a true story, which happened, which impacted them, and they passed it on to their children. We don't sit around yearly and discuss fables. We sit around yearly and discuss things of importance. And so the Pesach Seder itself is a place which we really should draw Emunah from. But it's all linking us back to the events of the Exodus. Those events are the events in history that should help us understand God and connect with who God is and what God does. And it shows us the power of God, the knowledge of God, God's will for the world, the reward and punishment, and really the fundamentals of Judaism are all found in the events of the Exodus. So that's one contemplation we can have to help strengthen our faith in God, is to think about the Exodus and how that story has come down to us to this very day. This conversation could go on for another 2 hours also, but we'll look at the next topic. Then you move on to Mount Sinai itself, the giving of the Torah of Mount Sinai. So again, we're putting the actual text of the Torah aside, but the events of Mount Sinai were extremely powerful. Every Jew heard God speak at Mount Sinai, man, woman, and child. So we talk about, you know, prophets, and we've had a limited number of prophets throughout history. But at Mount Sinai, every single Jew temporarily became a prophet. And every single Jew staying there at Mount Sinai heard God speak. And every single Jew heard God appoint Moses as his messenger. The Rambam says that one of the things we heard at Mount Sinai, we heard God speak to Moshe. Say, Moshe, you go and tell the Jews X, Y, and Z. Because God was at that point confirming to us that Moshe truly was his servant and his messenger, and Moshe's not making anything up. So that was part of the revelation of Mount Sinai. And the worlds that we said before, the three major religions of the Western world, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, all recognize this event. It was in Christian faith, the Muslim faith, and Jewish faith, obviously, that God spoke to the Jews at Mount Sinai. So the Christians will say, yeah, but then they messed up and we replaced them. Muslims will say something along the same way. But everyone agrees the event happened. Nobody argues in that event. And Jews recognize this event as what makes us Jewish. I mean, the fact that God took us out of Egypt, he said, okay, see you later. No, nice knowing you. But God took us to Mount Sinai and said, I care about each one of you individually. You're going to hear me speak. I'm going to give you my Torah. And the Torah, even though the Torah at times might seem burdensome, there's a lot of rules and regulations, but we're for the Torah as a gift of love. There's the blessing we say in the morning services, we say, Ava Rabba, God had abundant love for the Jews. And that blessing is about the Torah, because the Torah is a gift of love for us. Because that's where God told us, this is how you can fulfill yourself. This is how you can merit eternal life. This is how you can become the best person you can be, is through my Torah. This is the handbook and the manual for how to live as a human being. So the Torah is this love passed on to the Jews. And this event in Mount Sinai, when every Jew heard, so I'm not going to go through it right now, but you know, it's a really an impossible claim to make if it didn't happen. When we say 600,000 Jews, that was the men between the age of 20 and 60. So you add in the women, and the children, and the seniors. So a rough estimate, you're talking 3-4 million people there, maybe a bit more. And you have to be able to convince 4 million people that you heard God. If they didn't hear God, that's pretty difficult to do. There's a book, Rabbi Lawrence Kelman, you may have heard him before. He's a great speaker, a great writer. He has a book called Permission to Receive. And he there discusses, I think, four different approaches to proving the divinity of the Torah. And he has a long discussion of how this claim that God spoke to millions of people on Sinai cannot be falsified. It can't be a false claim. It's impossible, because there's no way to pass off of such a claim. The Torah itself even says that nobody will ever make such a claim besides the Jews. And it's true. Throughout history, many religions have started. And every single one of them has begun with either an individual or a small group saying, yeah, God came to us and told us X, Y, or Z. So we have no way to check them on that. You know, maybe yes, maybe no, but I don't know. I wasn't there at the time, and you're claiming it was just to you, so why should I trust you? But for the Jews, God went to every Jew. He didn't just go to Moshe and say, Moshe, let's start a new religion. He went to the entire people and said, okay, here I am. I'm God. I'm the Lord your God. I don't have any other gods, etc. until the Ten Commandments. And that claim, the Torah says, nobody will even make such a claim. Not only will it never happen again, but no other religion will make such a claim, and no one ever made such a claim besides the Jews, because you can't. You can't make up such a claim. Because there's no way to pass off. No, God spoke to 4 million people yesterday. Okay, where are these people? Mm-hmm. You're one of them. No, I wasn't. Yes, you were. No, I wasn't, you know? So there's no way you can... If I tell you God spoke to me yesterday, you'll say, maybe Rabbi Shir is crazy, maybe not, but like, you can't disprove me, you know? But if I say God spoke to you yesterday, then you could definitely disprove that, because you could say, no, he didn't. And if I could convince you, can I convince another 3 million people besides you? I mean, that's nearly impossible. So if you're interested in this, the line of thought, Rabbi Kelman has a great discussion of it in his book, Permission to Receive. But does that contemplation that this event happened, and the world's major religions all agreed to this event, and God spoke to 4 million people, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million, whatever number you're going to put on it, but millions of people on Mount Sinai, that is a very powerful contemplation, and should strengthen our emunah in the Torah, and show that our faith that the Torah is of divine origin, and its messages are powerful, and they should resonate with us and help us connect with God. So that's another contemplation we could have to help strengthen our faith in God. And again, this also could be discussed a lot longer, but I'm trying just to sum everything up in a short session here. The third point I'd like to discuss is the Torah's impact on the world. Eshet Torah has a wonderful presentation. They call it World Perfect, I think is what they call it. And they go through, I think, 7 different ways in which the Torah has changed the entire world since its giving.
What's it called?
World Perfect. I'm sure you can Google it. You might find it online these days. They do presentations in person. I think they have it online also now. So you can listen to it, audio, video, whatever. World Perfect. But it's a presentation showing how the Torah has changed the ideas of morality in the world, the ethics of the world, just the underlying culture of the world, all through this one book. Certainly, you know, I believe the Bible is the best-selling book in history, and it's something which has impacted every single human being to walk the earth ever since Mount Sinai. And that itself is something to contemplate. How could one book impact the world in such a powerful way if not it was divine? You know, there's no as good of an author as you can have, your book is not going to change society, change the entire world for thousands of years, you know, even if you're the greatest author in history. But the Torah did that, because the Torah's divine origin gave it that power. So, because God knows what the world needs, and God gave us the message, and God made sure the message spread to where it had to be spread. So just to contemplate, and again, this is a short contemplation you have to expand upon yourself, but to contemplate the impact of the Torah on the world for the past... the Torah was given approximately, let's say, 3,500 years ago. If that's 3,500 years, it's an astounding thing. So these are all contemplations that we went through in short. And each one is worthwhile to think about on your own. But there's a few other points I want to discuss, which kind of hit me more in a more personal way. And I want to discuss these a little more at length. And again, all these are just kind of food for thought. And each one of them should be expanded upon and kind of chewed over individually, if we want to really strengthen our connection with God. But something which I find extremely powerful in my own life is recognizing the depth and the wisdom of the Torah. So until now we discussed events, the Torah is being given, the Exodus, the Torah's impact on the world. But let's look at the actual information itself. And you can take this from many different angles. Let's think about it this way, a very fascinating contemplation. A child goes into kindergarten. And they're learning the basics of reading. So you give them a kindergarten textbook, you know, A, B, Jack and Jill, and you know, the different exercises they'll have, how to write it. By the end of kindergarten, we hope that they've already mastered that book, and they'll toss it in the trash, and they're ready for the first grade textbook. And that is in second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, 10th grade, 12th grade, kid goes to college. And the English books are always getting thicker, more complex, more complicated, and if you show a 30-year-old, the kindergarten textbook, it's a joke to them. It's, you know, it's way below their level, and you know, it's not even worth their time to look at. The Torah, you give the 5-year-old his chumash, this is his first copy of the Torah, and he'll take that Torah and he'll study it when he's in kindergarten. He'll study the same exact book in first grade, and second grade, and in third grade, and 10th grade, and when he's 20, when he's 30, and even when he's 95 years old, and he's the greatest sage of the whole generation, who's one of the sort of backs and forth, he's studying the same exact book. Now, how can one book fit the 5-year-old and the 90-year-old Torah giant, sage. How could that be? And the 30-year-old, 40-year-old, everyone in between. Because the depth of the Torah is unlimited. It's infinite. God is infinite. God's Torah is infinite. And just, you know, just like God is infinite, when he writes his work is something which is infinite in our minds. And therefore, it relates to every single person at their own level. And the kids, the 5-year-old kid's understanding of it is true and correct, but he's only getting layer number one. And as you get older and more mature and more experienced in Torah studies, so then you hit deeper layers and deeper layers. And then you get to that 90-year-old sage who's sitting and studying that same exact book as the 5-year-old, and he's in layer number 3,000 of depth, let's say, however many layers there are. And maybe the 50-year-old's at layer 1,500, and the 20-year-old's at layer 1,000. But it's all the same exact book, the same verse, the same words, the same letters, but it's an infinite amount of wisdom. No other book is like that. You know, even if you take, there's certain works, even though, let's say certain English works, people study in depth, take a work of Shakespeare. But you give the 5-year-old a work of Shakespeare, it's meaningless. Even for some 20-year-olds, it's meaningless, you know? But see a scholar studying Shakespeare, understanding the symbolism and this and that, there's a depth to it, certainly. But it's not going to be valuable for a 5-year-old. And plus, the scholar studies Shakespeare for 20 years, at a certain point, that's enough Shakespeare for me. Now I need something else to study. But Torah's not like that. The Torah, there's a value for the 5-year-old, there's a value for the 90-year-old, there's a value for the sage, there's a value for the layman, and it's all valuable, and it's all true, because there's layers and layers of understanding. So that's one very important way to contemplate, the contemplation which shows you the power of the Torah itself. And that shall help us appreciate the Torah and appreciate God. There is the concept that there is no area the Torah does not address. There's not an area in life, you know, you may need a sage to show you where the Torah addresses certain areas, but there's no area in life not addressed by the Torah. Time and time again, we're amazed by the depth of the wisdom offered by the Torah, whether it be into, certainly within religious law, but even into psychology, into people's mitos, character traits, into business interactions, ethics, morality. The Torah addresses everything. And as a new question comes up, so sages are able to find where did the Talmud discuss, you know, the kashrus of a microwave 2,000 years ago. And they could find that the Talmud addressed that. It didn't call it a microwave, it used a different type of example, but the Talmud understood that this possibility might come up and addressed it in a certain way. You know, where the rabbis address their approach to an iPhone? You know how should one approach an iPhone? What's the proper philosophy? You know, Jewish philosophy on how to, should you be on your iPhone all the time or not? So rabbis tell you, we see different examples of Torah where that was addressed. Because someone who's well-versed in the Torah can pull out from the Torah messages for every single part of life, no matter what. You know, cloning, artificial insemination, all these different things, they're all addressed in the Torah in some way. So you have great scholars. Now, I guess most recent years, Moshe Feinstein was known to be somebody who was able to address all these modern issues with the Torah's ancient wisdom. But we have people, the poskim, the halachic authorities of every generation are the ones who are charged with that job, but they do it because they know the Torah backwards and forwards, the Talmud, the Midrashim, halachic works, and they're able to then pull out information from the Torah to address every area of life.
But Rabbi, is it not just the inference that we're dealing with?
Well, usually it's an inference, but the point is that there's something to infer from, you know? I say a normal human author who's writing a law book, you're going to have gray areas and blanks and things which you just, he doesn't say anything about it here, I don't know what to say. But it's you don't find an area that the Torah doesn't address. So it might be through inferring it from a different case given, an analogy, a rule, some principle you find, but it's all addressed in there. That's my point. I mean, you're rarely going to find, you know, look, the rabbi said the word microwave over there. You're not going to find that. You're not going to find the rabbis talking about an iPhone, but we're talking about conceptually ideas which the principles apply to an iPhone or to a microwave. That's what I mean. And in terms of the depth of psychology as well, you know, I find that very often, you know, I have, thank God, I've been, you know, studying a lot of Torah over the years, and I find that certain ideas you find throughout the works of Pirkei Avos, commentaries therein, works of the Maharal, works of different Jewish thinkers, really mirror modern-day psychology books, modern-day thought in terms of character development and mitos. You find these things are timeless. The Torah has addressed them all. The Torah already has an idea of how to approach it. So the depth of Torah, and I'm sure you've experienced it, and as time goes on, the more you look at the Torah, the more questions you ask to people who are knowledgeable in Torah, you'll see the Torah addresses everything. There's nothing which is, there's no stone left unturned. There's also there's a concept we refer to as Das Torah, which is when you go to a Torah sage with a question. So we expect them to be able to answer us in all these areas only because they've studied so much Torah. When you go to a certain Torah sage, never went to college, never studied political science, never read history books, but, I mean, this happens in Israel all the time. They'll go and ask them questions about politics, about the economy, about finance, and they'll have an answer, a very good, reasonable answer, because they've studied Torah and thought through all the issues, even though they've never actually studied the actual topic in secular books. Because the Torah addresses all, and somebody who's absorbed the Torah through and through is able to address all the situations through the Torah's perspective. The Torah's perspective on all areas of life. You even have, I would take it even further, when you meet a Torah sage, you see how the Torah has impacted them as well. And I'll talk about this a little bit later, but by studying Torah, it changes a person. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And I'm putting aside, there are astounding stories of miracles done by great rabbis who studied Torah. You can go through story after story, whether it be a Hasidic Rebbe or just any great Torah sage. You find that there are certain insights they've had which were kind of miraculous. We call it Ruach HaKodesh. There's a divine spirit within them. There's famous stories of the great Chazon Ish, Rav Yeshaya Karelitz, who was really, he was the leading rabbi in Israel in the mid-1900s. He would map out brain surgeries. He never studied medicine. And there's one particularly famous story where someone came to him with a brain tumor. And he asked the question, should I go in for surgery in America? Should I stay in Israel? I think the story was along those lines. Where should I go? Help me determine what the right place to go for surgery is. And he told him, you have to go here. And he sketched out a diagram for the surgeon. And he said, do it this way. And the guy said, I'll take it to the surgeon. He'll make his own decision. And the surgeon looked at it and said, this looks great. I'm going to follow the Chazon Ish's suggestion. And the surgery was successful. He didn't perform the surgery, but he knew how to perform surgery from Torah study, because the Torah addresses every single area of life. And if you study Torah to its depth, you're going to eventually study the human brain and understand how the brain works too, because that's how it works. And there's certain insight that God gives to people who are great and pious, which through their Torah study and through their character, they're so such great and righteous people that they're able to perceive things which normal people cannot perceive. And to go on and tell stories of Torah greats doing miracles and working wonders, that could be another class. But that itself should also strengthen our amunah, see people like that.
Rabbi, what was the name of the rabbi?
He's referred to as the Chazon Ish, but his real name was Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, was his name. He lived in Bnei Brak, but he wrote a book called the Chazon Ish, which is what he was known as. He's known as Chazon Ish, that was his name. The next thing I want to talk about is what I would refer to as the experiential proof. And that's a term that borrowed from Rav Noach Weinberg's Zatzal, experiential proof. And the experiential proof means that one who actually lives with the Torah and studies the Torah should feel something, should feel a connection. So number one, somebody who lives a Torah lifestyle, observes the Torah's commandments, lives life based on the Torah's rules and regulations and virtues and ideas and philosophies. So that should and typically does lead to a fulfilling and meaningful existence. And one should feel that. I can't promise that's 100%, that every single person who ever tries to do Torah always feels fulfilled in meaning and feels the meaning of it. But I think as a general rule, it's true, for sure, from my experience, when I've seen people around, the people I've met and the families that I've visited and et cetera. And that, when you experience Torah lifestyle, then the truth rings with you. Because you say, this lifestyle is very meaningful, it's fulfilling, I feel a sense of purpose in life, I feel a happiness, I feel that it's a way to bring up a family, and a way to interact with friends, and a way to live a lifestyle. And that itself should strengthen our faith in God. Because we see, look, God's book really works. It turns out well. As difficult as it sounds, and as many rules as there are. And I never thought I'd give up eating lobster, but look, I give up eating lobster, and I'm happier than ever. So, and Rabbi David Orlovsky, he's a famous speaker in Israel, he's more of a comedian than a rabbi in many ways, he's extremely funny. But he said that he himself, I think, became religious later in life. And he said that people always came to him and said, how could you be Jewish? God wants you to enjoy the world, and you can't have shellfish, you can't eat pork, you can't go to that restaurant, you can't be kosher, it's so difficult. And he said, why do they get so upset with me? It's because they see me, and I live myself, and I regulate what I eat, so I control myself, I don't go out to that restaurant, I don't eat that food, but I'm happier than they are. And I've had a great time in life, and they're depressed, and they can't figure out why, because they're eating at the non-kosher, you know, establishment, and I'm regulating what I eat, and look at me, I'm much happier than they are. That's what Averofsky always says, you know? So it's part of the experiential proof, that sometimes you can't describe why is it that it works, but because it's God's rules, it does work. It makes a person feel fulfilled and happy. And then when it comes to the realm of Torah study, when one studies Torah, you should feel a personal connection with God. Torah study itself should get, Torah study is when your mind is actually wrapping itself up with God's wisdom. In a certain way, that's the most intimate connection one can have with God, because it's your mind is who you are. You know, we say, I think, therefore I am. That's what we are. We are our thoughts, our mind. That's really the basis of a person. That's what makes a human being. And when your mind is delving into God's wisdom, so that is a very intimate connection with God. That's about the closest with God a person can become. The more your mind is involved in God's wisdom, the closer you become with God. You should feel that connection. You should feel that personal the personal power the Torah has upon you. And even you can see it. If anyone's ever walked into a yeshiva and seen a large base medrash full of people studying Torah, there's electricity to it. So, like, for instance, I was 2 weeks ago, I was in Lakewood, New Jersey, Lakewood Yeshiva. It's the largest yeshiva in America. Probably has, I don't know, 6,000 students or something, which itself is astounding. There's 6,000 students studying Torah in one place. So there's several buildings there. But you walk into any one of the buildings, you walk into the base medrash, you have 1,000 people in one room studying Torah. And you know, you always have to contrast it to, you know, a college library or something, which is quiet and, you know, tame. And in there, everyone's screaming in the base medrash and yelling at each other and running around and looking at this and looking at that. But there's electricity. There's a vibrance. There's a power to it. You walk in, you're swept into it. You feel it. And even if you're not in a loud room like that, sometimes you look at someone studying Torah, and there's just a certain serenity to them because you feel a connection. It's not like you're lounging around reading a book, but it's, you know, you feel that I feel connected right now. I feel that I'm tying myself in with something which is powerful, which is lofty, which is, you know, dates back. You know, you're connecting with history. You're connecting with your great great grandparents. You're connecting with Mount Sinai. That's the thing one should get by studying Torah. And when one gets that feeling, that's the time to grab it, to savor that feeling, and say that this is going to strengthen my connection with God at this point. We should take that feeling and we should enjoy it. If you ever get a chance to walk in to see that yeshiva and you feel the electricity, stop for a second and say, let me feel the electricity. Let me feel the vibrance which is here.
But you don't have to go to Lakewood.
No, you don't have to go to Lakewood.
I went to Camp Mill.
You're good? Right.
And seriously, I used to go for Minyan's Marv at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And I'd go in the
field of the sun. Right. It's a different field, but you can get it, you know.
I'm just saying. They were in the midst of the discussions. And
yeah, right, you know. Even when you see 20 people studying in that way.
And you call this Chavrusa?
Chavrusa, yeah. Chavrusa, yeah. No, I'm just taking the extreme of like a Lakewood, like that size. You're right. You know, any place people are studying Torah with energy, with an excitement, you can feel it. You can see something. You can feel something. Also, the more a person studies Torah, and this takes some time and some effort, but we should really make our own discoveries within the Torah's wisdom. You make different connections, have new insights. There's something I've discussed before, we call it chiddush, that, you know, God leaves room for every individual Jew to find their own new insights in Torah. It has to be loyal to the text, loyal to tradition, you know, done carefully with the fear of God in mind. But people should make their own discoveries in Torah and find their own depths to Torah, which you know, which connect to them on a personal level. That was what we call chiddush, and the more a person studies, the more you say, wow, this wisdom has to be divine. There's no way human being could come up with that, you know? Chiddush is the word. Like the word hadash is new. So chiddush means it's a new insight. That's a chiddush. A new insight. There's also the power of Torah has to transform a person. Many of us have experienced it or met people who have felt that through studying Torah they've just become different people. You know, somebody who may have been wild and crazy and irresponsible, but then they study Torah for a while and suddenly that, you know, they've matured, they've grown, they're more responsible, they're more focused, their life has changed. People can realign their values, realign their life through the works, through the power of the Torah. And the Torah has the power to impact the human being and to change them. I have this impression every single year on Shavuos night in the yeshiva. So Shavuos night, thank God, you know, we have the custom to stay up all night studying the Torah. And thank God the yeshiva fills up. I mean, it's probably, all the rooms are full, the building's full. I mean, hundreds of people are there. And you're dealing with people of all ages, you know, ranging from age 8 to age 80, you know, but everyone's there, age 90. But but all night long studying Torah. So you're at 5 in the morning before they start davening, they always dance. They dance before davening. You know, it wakes you up, it gets you into it, gets you in the mood. But I always picture that, you know, so the yeshiva primarily is, you know, kids, you know, you have high school age kids and you have college age kids. So you're there, you're dancing at 5 in the morning with, you know, let's talk about these kids ranging from age, you know, 14 to age 24 or something. And picture the typical American kid who's 18 years old at 4 or 5 in the morning. You know, what's he dancing about? What's he doing? You know, so either he's fast asleep in his bed, or he's out with his friends doing who knows what, or watching a movie. And these kids are dancing after studying Torah all night long. You take the 22-year-old, take your 22-year-old college kid, what's he doing at 4 in the morning? What's he doing at 5 in the morning? What's he dancing about? And these kids they have self-control, they focus their lives on a certain goal, a certain ideal, and at 5 in the morning, they're dancing about the Torah. When you go 20 minutes down the road to College Park and look at what everyone there's doing at 5 in the morning, you know, it's not dancing on Shavuos night in the Hillel, you know, everyone else, what are they doing at 5 in the morning? And to me, that testifies to the power of the Torah to change a person. And what book can transform a kid to, instead of wanting to go out and watch movies or drink or hang out with girls or be involved in sports, to study the Torah and to dance about it at 5 in the morning? You know, where's that coming from? It's because coming from the power of the Torah itself to change people. And when you have somebody who's 30, 40, 50, or 60, but they change their values in life because they study Torah, it's impacted them, that's also astounding. Because Torah has the power to impact people. So again, this is another topic which could go on longer and longer, but I'll stop with that. But it's another contemplation, the power of the Torah itself to be able to influence, impact a human being. The last thing I want to discuss, which I found very interesting, is you do find areas of the Torah that predated science. There's many areas like this. There's a book which I just recently discovered, which goes through a lot of these different areas. The book is only in Hebrew at this point. I don't think I have it in English. It's called HaMehapech in Hebrew. It's written by Rabbi Zamir Cohen, who I actually think was recently spoken in Silver Spring, I think, in the past year. He's Israeli. He spoke to the Israelis in Kent Mill, in Shomre, to the Israeli crowd. He put out a book. He's well known in Israel as a Jewish outreach person, and he teaches, I think he has a TV show and a radio show. He does all sorts of stuff like that. But he has a whole book which discusses different areas where for millennia, people looked at the rabbis as being backwards, totally off base, what are they talking about, it doesn't make any sense. And only now, science is coming around to show that the rabbis are right the whole time. So there's some areas where we still don't understand what the rabbis are saying, but we know that eventually the science will come around to them too in those areas, because this is God's wisdom that the rabbis received in Mount Sinai.
His name again?
Rabbi Zamir Cohen. Z-A-M-I-R, I guess, Cohen. So I'm going to give you just a few brief examples. We don't have much time. Just a few examples where we find this. Number one is the world being round, right? That's the first example. So most history, people thought the world was flat. So everyone thought, we all know that, everyone thought the world was flat. No one can understand how could it be that the world is round, because you'll fall off the bottom, right? You can't live at the bottom of the world, you'll fall right off. You know, all these crazy theories to our history of how the world was held up, you know, it was on top of an elephant or a turtle. I mean, you know, all these different myths you hear, strange things, but the world is clearly flat throughout history. Everyone thought it was flat. And the idea of gravity didn't exist. And like that's why you thought you'd fall off the bottom. If you went off the bottom of the world, you'd fall into space. But where would you go? You'd fall off. Only really in the times of Christopher Columbus, his time and onwards, this idea of the world is round come into play. Then the discovery of gravity. And then we went into space, and we have pictures of the world being around. We know the world is round. We know people live in Australia; they're not falling off the Earth. That's how the world works. But this was unknown in science till the past few centuries. But we have a quote, an astounding quote from the Zohar. Zohar was, you know, it's a rabbinic work written by Rishim Bar Yochai. I guess it was around the year. I'm not good with years, but let's guess around the year 1 or 200 or so, something like that. Rosh Hashanah, where I live, might be off by a century or two, but it was a long time ago. And the quote says that, in the Zohar is really this basis of Kabbalah and mysticism. So this is about 2,000 years ago, and I'll translate the quote for you. He says that the entire world, settled world, is round like a ball. These people are on bottom, these people are on top. Every person looks different based on the climate in which they live, everyone in their land appears differently because the climate impacts them. And in these places, when it's light here, it's dark there. When it's dark here, it's light there. Now, as we know that when it's daytime in one hemisphere, it's nighttime in the other hemisphere. And then it says there's a place where it's daytime all day long and the sun doesn't set. And we're talking about the poles. And you're not going to find any night there. And vice versa. You have times where it's always night and you don't find any day there because it knows about the poles because the world is round. And this secret was given over to the Balei Chachma, the masters of the wisdom. That's a quote from the Zohar 2,000 years ago. Explicit gravity, the world is round. Explicit. The rabbis knew about this far before science knew. I'll give one more example and then we'll just stop because we're going over time. But I just want to share one more example. The Talmud discusses how many stars there are in the sky. Now, the scientific estimate for most of history was only what you could see with the naked eye, which is about 4,000 stars, they said. With the naked eye, you can see about 4,000 stars. You know, here with the light pollution, we see about 10 stars. But if you go to a place where it's totally dark, you go into the woods or something, you see a lot of stars. But it's about 4,000 you can see with the naked eye. Nobody could fathom that a star could actually be a whole distant galaxy. You're seeing it as one light. No one fathomed there is so many stars out there. But the Gemara, the Talmud in Maseches Brachos, page 32b, it gives a number of how many stars there are. And the way it works, you have to do the math, but it says that there's 12, what they call mazalos, the 12 different zodiac, it's a zodiac, zodiacal signs, I don't know how you'd say it, but astronomical signs, there's 12 of them. Each one of those has 30 groups of stars above it. Each of those 30 groups has another 30, goes another 30, another 30, another 30, and in that top 30, each one of them has 3,650,000,000 stars beyond that. So I mean, you have to do all the math, but the math comes out to about 10 to the 18th power of stars. It's a lot of stars. The rabbi said this at a time when the naked eye can only see 4,000 stars. And they're saying, no, it's not 4,000, it's 10 to the 18th power. 10 to 18, with 18 zeros after it. At this point, the NASA estimate of stars, it's an estimate, they don't know for sure, is 10 to the 21st power. So, you know, they're estimating, they're a little off the rabbi's fact. But I'm saying from a time when 4,000 was the common knowledge, the rabbis say, no, what's 4,000? It's 10 to the 18th power. So people thought, you're wacko. What are you talking about? It doesn't make any sense. But yet now science has come around to a number which is very similar to the rabbi's number, which is the 10 to the 21st power of stars. So that's another example. One more example is very quickly. Is the rabbis constantly discuss that the child is formed in the womb in 40 days. It's relevant in halachically to abortion is one place where it's relevant. It's relevant in many places halachically at 40 if the fetus is 40 days old or not. Less than 40 days old, the fetus is not yet considered a full child. 40 days is considered a child. Why 40 days? What happens at the 40th day? So for centuries, nobody knew what happened at the 40th day. The rabbis say that the child is formed on the 40th day, but they had no equipment to actually perceive that. They couldn't take an X-ray. They couldn't, they had no way to examine that. So in recent years, different scientists have discovered, this quote is from Professor David Ledger, I think of Washington University. He says that we know the human brain actually emits electric signals, and the smallest amount of electric signals in the human brain begin at 40 days, when the fetus is 40 days old, it starts emitting electric signals. So that's when the brain starts functioning in a fetus. Some British scientists have discovered that a fetus can feel pain at 40 days. But we see that there are actually things which modern scientists, unaware of the rabbi's estimate of 40 days, have said that 40 days is actually a very significant number in the development of a fetus. So the Torah itself is incredible. The wisdom, the depth, the ability to change a person, the areas in which it addresses, knowledge which it has, which far predated science. There's a verse which says, "Galenai, God, you should reveal my eyes, and I should see wonders from your Torah." And the more and more we study and feel and experience and think about Torah, the more wonders we perceive through the Torah, and that itself should help to maintain and strengthen our emunah in God. So these are big topics, all kind of summarized in a short class. But I hope everyone, please, each one's its own contemplation, and just take each one, think about it on your own, and hopefully that'll help strengthen your connection with God. Questions?